Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everyone to the Sandy Bob Show. We welcome our guests to chime in and make comments whenever they want. And today's topic is one world government and one world religion. And I always start my show with reminding everybody that we're living in kind of a holographic, kind of like a matrix, and many people are totally lost. They don't know what the truth is. So there's a solution to that, and that is to contact the real guides from the All Is. And the way you do that is you sing New You for about 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes at night, and you do that. I'll do that for a month or two, and the real guides will come to you in your dream state, and you can ask them any question they want, and they will immediately answer a lot of the questions that you have about what's real. And the way you sing New You is something like this. It's New You. Or I sometimes sing it like the Beatles song, New You. Doesn't really matter how you sing it. You want to sing it, you do not want to chant it. And let me just add something else here, something else that's not very well known. Human beings have five bodies, which they're not aware of. Most people are familiar that you have a physical body, but you also have a causal body, an astral body, a mental body, and an etheric body. And the astral body is the body you use. A lot of people will travel out of body, and they usually use their astral body for traveling around. Many people know that as astral traveling. You have your causal body, and people that go to look up the Akashic records, that's on the causal plane, so you can use your causal body to do that. And then your mental body, that's the third plane, or sometimes known as the third heaven, and that's where the god that most people worship hangs out. And I'll be getting into that a little bit more as we go along here. And then you have your etheric or kind of subconscious body. And all these bodies are encapsulated in this holographic cause and effect world that we're living in. And all of this cause and effect world or matrix, just like the movie Matrix that we're living in, is surrounded by a deep, dark border. The deep, dark border contains all of this, what we think is real, but is just an illusion. And the real guides will come in, and they will show you how to be like a little chicken being hatched from an egg. Just think of the deep, dark border as an eggshell, and you're the little chicken inside. And as you become more aware that you're a real being inside that shell, you can start pecking your way through and break through, and the bright sunshine will come in, and you'll see life as it was really intended to be. So once you break through that deep, dark border, then you'll be where the All is, and life is just so magnificent that words can't even describe it. So that's very interesting. Now, my main topic today was one world government and one world religion. I'll start with a one world government. And, you know, everybody knows that there's a New World Order group of people out there that are trying to establish a New World Order, a one world government. They're taking a whole bunch of countries and uniting them into small blocks, like over in Europe, they got the European Union, and in the United States, they have NAFTA, North and South America, and over in Asia, they have different blocks, and they're trying to build these blocks, and then eventually they're going to unite all these blocks into one central government, like underneath the pyramid. But anyway, I'm here to tell you that this one world government already exists. This idea of all these people like the Rothschilds, the bankers, and the Illuminati and all them setting up a one world government, it's just for show and tell. We're already under the one world government. And as I discussed last time, let me take a pause here for a second. Okay, sorry about that. My first hint came about there being a one world government or all these governments working together was during World War II, the Ford Motor Company and General Motors were making tanks and airplanes for the United States. But at the same time, they were also making weapons for the Germans. So, you know, why are we fighting a war when we have people making weapons for both sides against each other and claiming to be at war? But it's like there's another thing going on behind the scenes where everybody's working to, no, stand by a second. I'm waiting for another caller here.
It's not calling it at all.
Oh, it says it's waiting for host. Shoot, I gotta call this in again. I'm waiting.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Claudia in Texas.
Lottie, hey, the reptilians are at it again. They totally blocked us out.
I know. I couldn't get on either.
I can hear you.
I can hear.
Okay,
is everybody on?
Yes.
Okay, you still there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm not showing anybody on the show here. I've called in twice. Sandy, can you get in?
I'll try it
again. Sandy will try it again here. You couldn't hear me talking before then, I take it, when I was talking.
I could hear you.
Still, anybody?
Yes,
we
can
hear
you.
Could you
hear
me starting
Bob?
The show and everything? Could you hear me like 5 minutes,
Bob?
2 or 3 minutes ago? When I said, welcome to the show?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Okay, I can hear you now, but nobody showed up on the caller list. which is really, really bizarre.
We were all here. We all heard.
We're all here on the studio. Everybody's
about
here.
One world order and one world government and religion.
Okay,
yes.
And I invited Linda Moulton Howe to join us. Linda, are you on by any chance? She may not have called in or whatever before. Okay, well, apparently on the studio it shows nobody signing up or anything. Well, anyway, so let me try to pick up where I was. Anyway, I was talking about a one world government, and one of the things that I wondered, you know, that if all this government stuff is for show and tell. And when I discovered that the some of the corporations in the United States were working directly making arms in World War II for the Germans, and I was wondering, well, gee, that something here doesn't make sense. And anyway, then back in the 80s and 90s, I was doing additional research, and I found out that the in my research, there was a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island, where they talked about how the Federal Reserve Bank was created, and that was in 1913, about the time of World War One, and then we had the Rockefeller Bank in New York and the Bank of London joined together to fund an army to overthrow the czars of Russia and set up the Soviet Union. And here we have, it just doesn't make sense. If we have people within the United States and London, you know, creating an enemy, what's the purpose of creating an enemy? And so I had a lot of interesting questions. And as I was reading David Icke's book, I came across a few different things that really got my attention and that I was unaware of before. And I got to give David Icke credit for this in his Perception Deception book. And let me make a quote here. He says that all over the world are deep underground military bases known as dumb bases and whole cities in some cases, and the same within mountains. Now, you know, the other day on Val's show, I mentioned that I had a friend that worked for the CIA and started revealing Semyonov and the Pleiadians and some of this other information to me. She also told me that her uncle worked for the government and spent 35 years of his life building these dumb bases for the reptilians and the Nordics. So she had firsthand experience about all these things. Now, David Icke goes on to say, and this is page 499 in his book if you want to reference it, there is also a strong potential for a U.S.-China conflict in Africa with both sides working to seize the land and resources. And he says, I have long said, watch for the rise of China, because that is a crucial element in the whole planned archonic scenario. The archons, what he means by that is that he got the term archon from the writings of the what I would call the pagan Essenes, or, you know, back about the 3rd century A.D., they found a bunch of scrolls that had information, and you've heard about the Christian Essenes who were followers of Christ, but there was a bunch of pagan people there who had written extensively a lot of scrolls and texts about a group of people known as the Archons. And what the Archons were, basically they're the Orion reptilians and the Nordics that have been working together to create a race of reptilian beings that can shapeshift into human form and run the governments on the planet, so that the average person, the average human being, the 100% human being, would have no idea that their boss or the government leader that they're working under, or the tyrant in charge, or even their minister for that matter, is a shape-shifting reptilian that is normally in a reptilian form, but has the capability of shape-shifting into human form just for contact with human beings. Excuse me. Anyway, China is a base of global importance for the Archons and their bloodlines. The bloodlines, meaning the blue bloods, which we know about from Europe, they're the ones who have the shape-shifting capability at the very highest levels. And by the way, in case you're wondering why they call them the blue bloods, when they shapeshift or whatever, they are in the human form, their blood has about 20% more copper in it than the average human being does. And when they cut themselves or bleed, because of that high copper content, they actually, instead of being red blood, it's actually blue blood. And that's one of the reasons why they call them blue bloods. Now, here's the quote that really kind of knocked my socks off. American Freemasonic hero Albert Pike, the supreme pontiff of the Universal Freemasonry of the 19th century and inspiration for the Ku Klux Klan, is famous for a letter that he is said to have written in 1871. Now, what's interesting about 1871, let me diverge here to talk about 1871. You know, over in America, a lot of people have been bamboozled into believing that the United States was created by our forefathers to be a free nation, and we have all these alleged rights, and we're a free country, and all this. And what's very interesting is you know, maybe that was the intent on the part of some people, but the blue bloods, like George Washington, the Illuminati, George Washington, and a lot of these leaders of the American government, like Benjamin Franklin, were practically shape-shifting reptilians, and they were part of the Archon plan. And what's interesting about 1871, for those that haven't really studied into this, I know Mike has studied this extensively, but what happened is we had a civil war in the early 1800s, and what brought about the Civil War in the United States was the United States government, the United States of America, capital letters, capital U, small, united, and it came to an end at the beginning of the Civil War, and I've explained this before in other programs. The reason the United States of America ceased to exist, because under international law, whenever you set up a charter government or a corporate-type government, you always have to have a clause in there to give continuity of the organization or the corporation or government, whatever it is, under international law. You have to state reasons of continuity in case when your planned meetings for all the leaders or members of the organization to come and meet. If for some reason they're unable to meet, you have to have a plan B, and that has to be written in the Constitution. Well, the United States government didn't have a plan B, and right around the election time or fall of around 1860 to 61, they were supposed to meet in December. All the congressmen and senators were supposed to come to Washington and have their annual forum, but not enough people showed up for a quorum. And since they didn't show up, the corporate United States governor, or the whatever you call the United States of America, under that corporate charter, ceased to exist. But Abraham Lincoln was smart enough to know that it didn't exist, and so he declared martial law. Because his government, you know, here he is. Let me back up one more step. The central government of the United States was where the member states got together and they wrote a charter for a central government. Well, when that central government ceased to exist by international law, Abraham Lincoln tried to step in and say, okay, wait a minute, guys, you know, I'm still president, you know, even though my government, you know, you elected me to be president of the central government, just because the central government doesn't exist, I'm still going to declare martial law and try to get things under control, and we'll try to set it up to where we can get back together and get everybody organized and solve some of these issues, whether it's slavery or the North stealing all the money from the South, whichever version you want to look at. But anyway, he tried to hold things together, and then we had all this outbreak and hostilities, which we know is the Civil War. And then at the end of the Civil War, as Abraham Lincoln was trying to get everything organized and relaxed, he went out to watch a movie, and they murdered him before he could reestablish the United States of America. And in reality, the central government, the United States of America, was in Never Never Land from 1865 until 1871. And what happened in 1871 was the generals of the North, like Grant and some of these people, got together and they said, well, let's not let a good thing, you know, go by. Let's restart the United States of government, but we will be dictators. Well, our president will be total dictator, and Congress will only be advisory to the president. And so they established the United States dictatorship. I'll call it a dictatorship, but it was still under the pretense of restoring the original Constitution for the United States of America. And I have actually seen that document. It was in a law library at Yale University, you know, home of the skull and crossbones and all that. But I have actually seen a copy of the document where General Grant, being the first president of the new dictatorship of the United States, set up, and that's when Black's Law Dictionary first started. 1871 was the first year that Black's Law Dictionary was created, and Black's Law Dictionary redefined a lot of the terms used in government so that the new dictatorship under Grant could try to hide the fact that they were just a corporate dictatorship and Congress was advisory in nature only. So here we are. We're setting the stage of the shape-shifting reptilians setting up their one-world government in the United States. And after that, the only true law of the land is presidential executive order. That's the only true law of the land. All this stuff that Congress does, they pass all these acts and all these laws here and there. There's some enforcement on those laws, but it's all for show and tell. And that's why when you go into a courtroom and you say, well, here's the law, and you try to argue some point, and they say, well, you know, if they like you, they're going to approve it. If they don't like you, they're going to say BS, and they're going to rule their own way. And the reason they do that is because the judges have total control over the courtroom, and there is no law other than executive order. So I've talked to several judges that have gone through the judge school, and they're taught that when they go through the judge school, that they have total control over whatever goes on in their courtroom. They can rule any way they want, regardless of what the local law is, because the only real law of the land is executive order. But they do have to follow the executive order. So anyway, so here we are in 1871. The United States has just been made into a dictatorship under former General Grant, being the new president of the American United States Government Dictatorship Corporation. And so here you have good old Albert Pike, and he's written some interesting books. And he also started the Ku Klux Klan, you know, really nice guy. Anyway, he wrote a famous letter to Italian bloodline agent and mafia founder, another good buddy of Albert Pike, the founder of the Italian mafia, and his name was Giuseppe Mazzini. And what Pike did is he outlined the three world wars that would lead to global domination by the reptilians or the archons. And Albert Pike, you know, now they're starting to bring in the term Illuminati. So Albert Pike starts using the word Illuminati, and that was brought in for the benefit of a lot of people that would be talked into joining the Illuminati, and they were told that the Illuminati they'll take care of you and your family, and you'll never have to worry about getting a job and all that kind of stuff. And they lie through their teeth and get people to join and donate money to the cause. Well, anyway, in this letter to Giuseppe Mazzini, Albert Pike writes, he says, "The First World War must be brought about in order to permit the Illuminati to overthrow the power of the czars in Russia and of making that country a fortress of atheistic communism. The divergences caused by the agentur of the Illuminati between the British and the Germanic empires will be used to foment this war. At the end of the war, communism will be built and used in order to destroy the other governments and in order to weaken religions." Okay, so in 1871, these archons or reptilians knew that they were going to do World War One and bring about atheistic communism and be that organization, and sure enough, it has happened. It was created by the Rockefellers and the royal family through the Bank of London over in England. Now, you talk about planning ahead. He goes on to say, "The Second World War must be fomented by taking advantage of the differences between the fascists and the political Zionists. This war must be brought about so that Nazism is destroyed." You know, and there wasn't any, in 1871, there wasn't any Nazis. So, I mean, they had this all planned out. As a matter of fact, Hitler was a relative of one of the British leaders, and that's another story in itself. Anyway, this war must be brought about so that the Nazism is destroyed and the political Zionism will be strong enough to institute a sovereign state of Israel in Palestine. So, right after World War II, of course, everybody knows that in 1848, the State of Israel was established by the Rothschilds in Palestine. During the Second World War, international communism must become strong enough in order to balance Christendom, which would then be restrained and held in check until the time when we would need it for final social cataclysm. And he goes on and he says, "The Third World War," which is coming up next in their plan, "The Third World War must be fomented to take advantage of the differences caused by the agentur of the Illuminati between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. The war must be conducted in such a way that Islam, the Muslim Arabic world," now we're talking Iraq, Iran, all the Middle East over there, "and the political Zionism, the State of Israel, and we must arrange it to where the Muslims and the State of Israel mutually destroy each other." Does that sound like what you're reading in the news every day? I mean, Trump just sent a carrier fleet over to the Middle East yesterday, I think it was, carriers and fighter planes and everything over there, and there's a lot going on over there. Meanwhile, okay, let me continue this letter. Meanwhile, the other nations, once more divided on this issue, will be constrained to fight to the point of complete physical, moral, spiritual, and economic exhaustion. We shall unleash the nihilists and the atheists, and we shall provoke a formidable social cataclysm, which in all its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism, origin of savagery, and of the most bloody turmoil. Then everywhere, the citizens, obliged to defend themselves against the world minority of revolutionaries, will exterminate those destroyers of civilization and the multitude disillusioned with Christianity, whose deistic spirits will from that moment be without compass or direction, anxious for an ideal but without knowing where to render its adoration, will receive the true light through the universal manifestation of pure doctrine of Lucifer, brought into the public view. The manifestation will result from the general reactionary movement, which will follow the destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time." So anyway, I thought that was really kind of interesting that they would know, way back In 1871, as Claudia said, you know, when you have reptilians that have an IQ of 10,000 and live to be millions of years old, you know, this is nothing for them. It's like us planning what we're going to do next week. You know, that would be a fair comparison. Wouldn't you say, Claudia, if you're there?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
So, yeah, so it's part of the planning. Now, another thing I came across, and I was reminded of this. My friend with the CIA, she was an original member of OSS in World War II. She infiltrated the German Luftwaffe and was in training. She became a pilot and was a flight instructor training the Luftwaffe pilots how to fly their aircraft. And one interesting thing that she did that was really kind of interesting was she got selected by the Germans to start flying their and flight instruct on their new 120 or 130 foot diameter flying saucer that they were building. One of the biggest problems that the Germans had over there was they had their Foo Fighters, which were small flying saucers, and they could fly circles around our B-17 bombers, and they could fly circles around their P-51s. And they could actually fly circles around that twin-engine jet fighter that the Germans built, that ME-262, which my friend Laura Jean, she actually flew those and flight instructed with them. And the interesting thing was in 1943, as they were developing and completing, they'd already built several of these 130 foot diameter UFOs. It was to solve the weight and balance problem because they wanted to use them for bombers, but the small craft had a very narrow weight and balance problem, so it was really hard to carry bombs and drop bombs, and even have machine guns on those small craft that they had, because if they carried 50 or 100 pounds of ammo, by the time they shot all the ammo, the craft would be so out of balance they'd have to go land immediately before they crashed it, because it was a weight and balance issue. And if you're familiar with weight and balance, they have to be balanced delicately. Something like a helicopter has to be very balanced when they have a single rotor. The craft that the Germans, the small craft they had that same problem. They had a very narrow band for weight and balance for whatever they loaded inside the craft. Anyway, so they started building these larger craft, and they were set up to have, they had howitzers on them, and they had bomb racks, and they were going to bomb the living daylights out of everything, and they were going to win the war. However, as we just read, it was never intended for the Nazis to win that war. And so they actually had a training date for her. This was in 1943, and in March of 1944, she was going to start her training the other Luftwaffe pilots how to operate these things. But before that came about, the Germans, they had 9 tanker-sized submarines. They decided to pack up, take all their machinery and everything. They'd pack it up and put everything on these submarines and take it down to South America and eventually down to New Schwabenland, which was a base that they built at the South Pole in Antarctica. And my friend Laura Jean, I was talking to her. Unfortunately, she died about 3 or 4 years ago, and I can't pick her brain anymore. But she said that in the year 2010, which was like 9 years ago, the population of New Schwabenland was over 2 million. You know, and you never even hear about it in the news, but they had over 2 million people living and operating out of New Schwabenland down in Antarctica. So it was a huge operation, and it's still a huge operation today. But anyway, she knows about that. The Germans had been to the moon with their craft, you know, and of course, one of the most interesting things about all this was part of the plan was when the Nazis, or the, I should say the Germans, lost the war, the United States government and the British government and the Rothschild-controlled Soviet Union all worked together to divide up the Nazi scientists and the people in Germany at the end of the war. And in the United States, the government arranged a plan that they called Operation Paperclip. And what they did with Operation Paperclip is the Americans brought 1,600 of the highest level engineers and technicians to the United States to start our space program, which turned out to be NASA, and that was run by the Nazi that most people know as Wernher von Braun, and he was the leader of the pack, and he's the one that designed all the rockets and everything. And they also brought over technicians for the UFOs, and they set all them up over at Wright-Patt Air Force Base and had them start working on the UFO technology and advanced aircraft technology, and they went to White Sands and other places like that. And this was not very well known. Another 20, generally speaking, in most of the places you'll read, you'll find that there were 20,000 other civil servants from that were Nazis that came to America, and they took over all the public offices like the Department of Education and throughout all the states and in the federal government, and they pretty much took over everything. They became really big wheels in the organization. And I have a lot to say about our 41st president, George Herbert Walker Bush Sr., Daddy Bush. I have some interesting information I'll be reading shortly about that. But anyway, what was interesting was the ones that the Nazi scientists and ones that did not come to the United States, the rest of them went to the Soviet Union and started the Soviet Union's rocket program, and they started sending up rockets, and they also they were the first ones to send up you know about Sputnik and all that stuff that was going on. Well, unbeknownst to the American public, the Nazis were collaborating with each other. It didn't matter whether they were here in the United States or over in the Soviet Union. They were all working together. And just an example of how well they worked together, Sandy and I have very firsthand experience about that. When Kennedy announced that, you know, somewhere around 1961 or so, that he challenged the American people to send a man to the moon and return him safely to Earth. Well, Kennedy knew all about this program. He knew all about the Nazis. He knew that we had Wernher von Braun in the United States working with the scientists over in Russia, and we actually we had the smarter guys, and we were much more advanced than the Soviets, but we had to delay some of our rocket launchings just so the Russians could put theirs up first and say, hey, we got a space race with the Russians. Well, we were working with the Russians all along. John F. Kennedy knew that, and actually part of one of the reasons he got assassinated, he was going to reveal some of that. But anyway, when it came to sending, in 1969, when they sent Neil Armstrong to the moon, what really happened, the truth of what really happened was the Americans launched our three astronauts. You had Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, I think it was, and the third guy, and they never left Earth orbit. They just never got out of Earth orbit. They just went round and round and round for that whole duration that they said they were on the moon. And Claudia, I know that you watched them, you know, doing all the moonwalkings there at NASA, and they did some more out in Utah where they took the rocky landscapes, and then they had the some of the close-up settings, they were all staged, and they used a backdrop of a reverse, kind of like a movie screen, where they projected the background from the backside of the screen. It's kind of some sort of reverse projection screen, and they filmed a lot of the moon scenes based on that. Well, anyway, interestingly enough, what happened was, as Neil Armstrong and those guys were going around in orbit around the United States, the Soviets once launched another vehicle up into space, and they docked with Neil Armstrong. It was a Russian cosmonaut who docked with Neil Armstrong's vehicle, and they took our lunar lander, and this Russian cosmonaut took off and went by himself off to the moon, and it was a one-way trip because they knew that he could never make it back. And after going through the Van Allen belts, the amount of radiation that he would get going through the Van Allen belts, he knew it was a one-way trip, and he volunteered to go to the moon. And so today, when Neil Armstrong and all the NASA scientists say we went to the moon, well, it reminds me of an old story my dad told me. He says, you know, me and Pa killed the bear. Pa shot him. Well, you know, we humans went to the moon. It wasn't Neil Armstrong or any of them. It was a human cosmonaut that went. So we went, but we really didn't. Neil Armstrong really didn't go. It was the Russian cosmonaut. And he went there, and I guess he made a safe landing. And what was interesting was Sandy and I were down in Florida on vacation. What was that, about 5 years ago? About 5 years ago, Sandy and I went down to vacation in Florida, and I wanted to rent an airplane because I'm a commercial pilot and I like to fly, and I wanted to rent an airplane where I could just go fly up and down the coastline and fly around Naples, Florida. That's where we went. And so we go out to the airport, the local airport, and I'm looking for a place that rents airplanes, and we find this one place, and we go inside, and we start talking to the guy running the show. And while we're talking to him, the weather became almost unflyable. We had like 30 or 40 mile an hour winds and about 1,000 foot ceiling. So what I wanted to do was untenable. And we got to talking to this guy, and it turns out this guy invited us out for a steak dinner. And we thought, well, gee, what an honor, you know. And so we go out to this. He invites us out to the steak dinner, and we're sitting there talking to him. And so I asked him. I said, well, how did you come about, you know, starting your own FBO? And he says, I'm from Russia. And I said, well, what'd you do in Russia? And he says, I was one of the professors in the astronomical, the largest, most famous Russian astronomical. Or astrophysics university, and he taught astrophysics and spaceflight. He was one of the professors that was involved with spaceflight. That was one of his specialties. And I thought, wow, this is really neat, you know, talking to this guy. And I had just finished reading a book that was written by a couple of researchers, and you can find this book. I have a copy downstairs. I don't recall the name of it. But these guys go in and they in this book, they explain the same thing I was just saying, that it wasn't Neil Armstrong that went to the moon. It was this cosmonaut. And so while we're sitting there and, you know, while we're eating and we got waited on, they served our steak. And I said to him, just as he was taking a bite of his steak, I said, well, since you're from Russia and all that, you must know that Neil Armstrong never went to the moon. It was your cosmonaut that went. And he let his jaw drop. He dropped his fork on his plate, and he had this bewildered look on his face. His eyes got big as silver dollars, and he says, "How do you know this? How do you know this?" And I said, "I just finished reading this book where they talk all about it." And he says, "Americans aren't supposed to know that." And I said, "Well, I know it because I just read a book, and that was proven to me." And he says, well, it's really true. That's exactly what happened. He said, that's exactly what happened. And over next to their, one of their launch bases over in the Soviet Union, they built a huge memorial for this cosmonaut in memory of his volunteering for his one-way trip to the moon. So, you know, we had, you know, full confirmation of how the cosmonauts this one cosmonaut went to the moon using our craft, and everything else was faked. And that's why, of course, you know, if you watch Armstrong and his first talk after they got back and everything, that after the first interview, Neil Armstrong refused to talk about the space mission anymore. He became a real recluse and wouldn't go in public anymore because he just did not want to be recognized as the first man on the moon when he never left Earth orbit. I can tell you another quick story that's all related to that. It's kind of interesting. And that is, back in the mid-90s, I got a job working down in Champaign, Illinois, and it was a night shift, and in the morning I'd go over to one of the local diners and have breakfast, and this one particular night, this one weekend I had off, and since I was so used to the night shift, I tuned into a shortwave radio program back when there was this guy that wrote a book called Behold the Pale Horse, and he used to go around the schools telling people what the truth was about UFOs and all that. Anyway, he had a radio show on talking about the NASA moon program, and he had five engineers on his program. And these five engineers surprisingly, they had five proofs that Neil Armstrong never went to the moon. They had actual five proofs. And the next morning, I went out to eat at the diner. It was a chef, and I was sitting at the counter with the stools, and the day chef was cooking eggs and pancakes right across from me, right across the aisle, and I could talk to him. And I said, "Did you hear that Neil Armstrong never went to the moon?" And he turns around, looks at me kind of funny. He says, "Well, what makes you say that?" And I told him I just listened to this talk show, you know, a couple of days before, where they had gave five reasons why they could never have made it. And he says, "Well, let me tell you something interesting. I was the senior security officer on board the carrier that picked up Neil Armstrong. I was on the carrier that picked him up, and I was the only one with a top secret clearance, and I'm the one that did all the communication from the carrier to the Pentagon to the president's office, and I knew everything that was going on." And he says, "It's really funny that you mention that, because all my friends within the intelligence community, were saying the same thing. That was all a put on. No, Neil Armstrong never went to the moon." And he says, "I haven't thought about that, you know, for, you know, 20 years. And he thought, "Well, man, let me call up some of my friends." Well, as it turns out, I didn't go back the next day. It was about 6 weeks later before I got back into the restaurant, and I just could not wait. I got sidetracked and did a move. I moved out about 30 miles east of town, and I get off this one morning. I come over there and walk in the restaurant, and he isn't there. He's not cooking. And so I am just so anxious to find out what he found from his intelligence buddies, and he wasn't there. So I asked. They had a new cook on, so I sat at the same counter, and they had a new guy cooking. I asked, "Well, where's what's his name? The guy I talked to that was here, you know, 6 weeks ago." And he says, "I don't know what you're talking about." And I said, "Well, you know, the guy that was in here, I'd come in every day for about, you know, I was coming in every day for, you know, a couple months, and I'd talk to him every time I came in, and he was there cooking away." And he says, "Son, I have no idea what you're talking about. I've been here for over 2 years. Are you sure you got your facts straight?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And there was, and one of the interesting things about this little restaurant was they had one morning waitress who was blonde and beautiful and so attractive. I mean, you'd never forget her in a million years. And I remembered her specifically watching me, you know, talk to this guy. And so I got up and she was on the far side of the diner, and I went up to her and I said to this waitress, I said, well, you know, I came in here and talked to this other guy, and she says, I have no idea what you're talking about. He's right. He's been here for 2 years. What are you talking about? And about that time, I was getting really frustrated, and I said, all right. And there's a diner full of about 50 people, you know, eating at their tables and everything. And I said, I know damn well you know what I'm talking about. And I made a scene. Everybody dropped and looked at me in this restaurant talking about, you know, not being bashful. I said, I know damn well you know exactly what I'm talking about. And then she stops what she's doing. She says, okay. All right, you're absolutely right. He wasn't here, but he died about 3 weeks ago. And he's not working here anymore because he died. And that's all she could tell me. So additional confirmation, they killed this guy for even investigating the clues. So they're still trying to keep that a secret. But anyway, if you get a chance to walk up to these astronauts and they say, we went to the moon, well, when they say we went to the moon, it's like me and Pa shot a bear. We didn't go. The cosmonaut went, but collectively, we really did go. And that's how they can tell you with a straight face that we went to the moon. Well, anyway, there's something else about the moon project. I don't know if they went back with any more stuff after that, because I never really followed after that, because they might have done some additional things. They said they had a bunch more flights that went. And then it stopped abruptly. But I do know that, you know, even the Nazis were on the moon, you know, back in the 30s and 40s with aircraft, and I'm sure the U.S. and everybody else was there. So they went to the moon, but they just didn't do it on the Apollo program. Now, one of the interesting things about the moon is it's an artificial construct. For anybody that is not aware of this, the moon is an artificial construct, and it's hollow inside, and the U.S. government and other agencies set off explosives, low-charge explosives, and they crashed vehicles. They put seismographs on the moon, whether it was manned or unmanned. They put these seismographs on, and they crashed a couple vehicles into the moon, and it just echoed. It reverberated like it was hollow. And then they did something in the late 90s, they set off a charge that was like the equivalent of like 10,000 pounds of TNT, and they set that off on the moon. And what they found was they didn't get an echo like they did with smaller charges. What they found was the entire surface of the moon has vibration and impact dampeners in it, just like out in Colorado in the Cheyenne Mountain, where they have those offices inside. All those are set on a spring shock absorbing method. So if a nuclear bomb goes off outside the building, you know, the building's going to shake like a big earthquake, but these springs that they have underneath all the flooring absorbs the shock. Well, it turns out the moon, the surface of the moon is made up of titanium and other exotic metals to protect the inside. So it's an artificial construct largely covered with titanium, and the craters are artificial craters to make it look like it's a real moon, and the ones that weren't artificial are just dense, you know, where they had big impacts. The craters are actually dense, where the aluminum got dented but not broken through, and you'll see that in some of the writings. Scientists are wondering, well, why are these big craters so shallow? Well, it's because they hit titanium instead of mud, you know. That's where why they're kind of shallow there. Well, anyway, let me take a break here and see if anybody wants to add or comment about this. Anybody have anything to say about all this? Feel free to speak up.
Yes, thank you. This is really informative. This is Claudia in Texas, and I just wanted you to know you're right on, spot on. That's exactly the way it was. It just so happened I happened to work at NASA as a young engineering student back in the 60s. And one of the things that I noticed when going to work early in the morning or getting off work late at night, that there was a portion of the back yard of NASA in Houston that was decorated to look like the surface of the moon. And they would take out equipment, and they also had very large cameras and all kinds of photographic equipment. And the memo that went out to the general workers at NASA in Houston at the Johnson Spacecraft Center was, oh, we're practicing for the moon rocket, and it looks just like it. And it did. It looked just like it, and you would see the astronauts in their suits, and you would see the lunar lander and all kinds of interesting equipment moving about. And it would all take place between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. before the morning shift got there. So, yes, a lot of stuff happened. And my other comment is that if you have research available to look into on reverse speech, when you play Neil Armstrong interview back on reverse speech, you hear him say, it didn't happen, it didn't take place, I didn't go. And so there are proofs out there, very scientific, and you can't deny it. So thank you so much for opening up the discussion.
Well, thank you very much for that, Claudia. Anybody else want to make a comment?
Just a question about who created the moon. What's its use and purpose for? You know, what is it used for? Start with those if you know the answer. Anybody?
This is Claudia in Texas. I have a partial answer. Because our particular planet was discovered by the Orion population, the Orion people who were looking for gold, and they discovered a lot of it just laying on the ground on the planet Earth, they came here and took control of it. And so part of their need to deal with other extraterrestrials coming here and wanting gold too, they had to set up a place where people, a staging area, where people, where others could meet, talk, converse, and work out a plan to divide up the spoils. So the moon was constructed very cleverly. It looks just like a barren surface, painted gray, has shallow meteors, and they, you know, imported dust around it to make it look real. But all of it is just a hologram that is available 24/7 for us to look at, and we get deceived. This is their plan to deceive the human population of everything that we think is real is not.
Well, thank you, Claudia. David,
thank you, Claudia.
Go ahead, Val.
Yeah, thank you. That explains a lot. It's a staging area. And so, again, the purpose of, one question for probably Bob is, like, how do they, if we have been to the moon, how do we get through the Van Allen belt?
Well, when you're going through the... You know, when you have the capability of, like, deep space transportation, where you go through the Van Allen belt, well, with the craft, they can go around the Van Allen belts. They can go up around the poles, and they can go around the Van Allen belts and still get to the moon. The Russians, I understand, were getting to the moon in something like less than half an hour, 30 minutes.
Okay.
I know that Semyonov or Pleiadians, before they left the planet, they were going back and forth from the Pleiades. It took them 7.5 minutes from the Pleiades, which is 500 light years. And the Russians, I mean, their craft, I mean, they were going over 10,000 miles an hour, and they could circumvent, or they're bigger craft. They could actually go through the Van Allen belts at such a high speed that it would be less than an X-ray of exposure, you know, going through the Van Allen belts. They could go through them so fast. Now, there was, but it takes that technology. Sometime in the last 6 months or a year, they had a astronaut, a new astronaut, young guy, probably 30 years old, talking about the space program, and he let it slip. He says, "Well, one of these days we'll figure out how to get through the Van Allen belts with our public technology." And he let that slip out. But with the Apollo technology, that's gonna be a fatal exposure to the radiation. You know, and you see some of the people today saying, "Well, the Van Allen belts don't have that much radiation." Well, they really do have that much radiation. One thing I was going to say about the moon was David Icke said that during a lot of these changes in the solar system when they brought the moon in, at one time the Earth used to orbit the planet Saturn, and Saturn was the object of worship. And then something happened that caused the Earth to get located to a different spot. So they brought in the moon to put the moon around. All of a sudden, the Earth was no longer going around Saturn; it was going around our Sun in a different, completely different orbit. And so they brought in the moon at the same time that physical change took place. And a lot of this is written about by Velikovsky in his books, Worlds in Collision. I don't know if you ever read any of his books, but there were some really big catastrophes that actually took place. But David Icke says that before the moon was brought in, when Earth orbited the Saturn, all the reptilians were worshiping the archons on Saturn. And that's today one of the reasons why practically every symbol on the planet having to do with the reptilians and the Illuminati, they are symbols of Saturn worship. You know, they kind of worship the Saturnalia. And that's, I mean, like the crescent, like you know, you see the hammer and crescent, you know, like on the Soviet flag. Well, that any crescent is symbolic of worshiping Saturn. The all-seeing eye that you see like on the dollar bill and all that kind of stuff, the CBS symbol, that is a symbol for Saturn. The Kaaba, the big black stone that the Muslims worship over there at Mecca, that is a symbol for Saturn. And David Icke goes into it very, very extensively. And he says the moon was brought in to amplify the signals that the people living on Saturn used to transmit, broadcast the information they wanted to broadcast into the subconscious of their subjects. And so, I think one of the last times I talked, I said when I was a professor at a small university down on the south side of Chicago, one of our standing jokes with the students was, we said that education is a process whereby the notes of the professor become the notes of the student without passing through the minds of either. Well, what the archons and reptilians do is they broadcast their thought processes right into our subconscious without passing through our minds. It's the same exact thing. It's broadcast through our DNA at the lowest levels. And David Icke says that, you know, since the Earth got relocated out away from going around Saturn, they brought in the moon to be an amplifier, to amplify the signals from Saturn because it was so far, far away. And so they have amplifiers inside the moon that transmit, that amplifies and transmits the same information into our subconscious. So we believe at the subconscious level, we believe that we're sinners and kind of buy into the religions and all these other things that they're trying to get us to believe in, which really isn't truth. But that was another construct of the moon. And I think that a lot of those craters are actually parabolic dishes you know, for different wavelengths that they transmit the information, and they probably also have spying information. They probably have a lot of antennas that are used to collect information from the planet, and that's why the moon always faces the Earth, because that's the focus of the transmitters and receivers on the moon toward the Earth. So that's David Icke's input anyway. By the way, one of the things I was thinking the other day, you know, the question is, well, why did we never go back to the moon, you know, where people could start drilling into the moon and start mining it and all that kind of stuff? Well, I was thinking, well, if you owned a $20 million Learjet, how would you like it if somebody walked out to the airport with a bunch of drills and started drilling into your airplane just to see what was underneath? You wouldn't like that very well either. Well, the reptilians that own the moon don't want anybody drilling into their prize object over there and messing up with their plan. So I just thought that was kind of an interesting input. I don't know, does that help at all, Val, answer any of the questions?
Yeah, this is not something I've been learning in my history class at GCU, where I'm taking history. They didn't tell me any of this, so I'm glad I tuned in today. Thank you.
Well, anyway,
may I offer a side comment?
Go ahead, Claudia.
About the radiation belt, one of the ways they overcome that is that the reptilians with the very, very excessive technology created portals. And I'm going to refer to that series Stargate that we watched from the movie where they walk through a ring and they're at the other planet. How they did this was there would be jump rooms positioned on the Earth and jump rooms exactly positioned on another planet. So if they wanted to go to the moon and bypass the radiation belt, all they did was walk into a jump room, dial in a number, and in a few seconds they would be in another planet, walk out of the room, no problem. So that might be one of the other ways they move about without having to deal with dangerous radiation levels and eliminate wear and tear on the body.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, that Stargate program, like in the movie, that's the one in the movie, they found the Stargate out in the desert. Well, I should tell you that the CIA found one in the ice down in Antarctica, one that was 3 foot diameter, and it had the ring of very precious metals, and the center was a 3 foot diameter precious stone. And when they activated it, would become kind of like a vapor, just like in the movie Stargate, and they could go through that also. And it took them a while to figure out where that one went, but they finally figured it out. And that was a smaller version of the one like in the Stargate movie. So, I mean, they're out there. They're out and about in those jump rooms, you know. A lot of that was developed through at Montauk. And like I said, my friend Pete manufactures these jump rooms for the governments. They know exactly how to do it. The humans actually know how to do it. So thank you, Claudia. That was an excellent comment.
You're welcome.
Well, anyway, part of my topic today is the one world government. So I've showed you how the United States and Europe, the Russians, and they're kind of tied together, and how the Soviet Union fits in the scheme of things. Well, one thing I haven't really talked about is how does China fit in the scheme of things? Well, anyway, I was doing a search trying to find out more about the Red Dragons that Dwayne the Great Writer, Dwayne Hepner, was talking about. And, you know, he said that that Dinar RV will not go through unless the Red Dragons of China approve it. Well, there's a YouTube that you can watch. I watched the YouTube about all this, and they are Sandy wanted to say something, I'm not sure what, but the There's a group of people, bankers in Europe, that are called the Rothschilds. And the Rothschilds are the ones who control the banking system. And well, Sandy saw me. She doesn't want me to share this. Oh, okay. So anyway, I guess I need to take that up at a different time. But anyway, the Red Dragons are a group of reptilians in China, and they are working with the other reptilians. And there's the Red Dragons, and there's the green dragons. And the green dragons they control the areas where you have green flags, like in the Middle East, the Iranians, and a lot of the Middle East countries have green in their flags. And those are controlled by the green dragons. Anyway, so that's kind of how the governments are tied together. Now, well, we're kind of running out of time, too. And as far as one world religion is concerned, the one world religion is you have Grog, who is on the mental plane, and he's a three-headed god. And Val, maybe you could explain who the three-headed god is for everybody. Could you take a minute and explain that to everybody?
Well, he's positioned himself. I mean, he's just like anybody else in a way, but he's worked himself up to a position of authority, control, power through his ruthlessness, through his cleverness. And again, he's just like kind of any president here, working his way up through deals and brutality and everything like that. And then he finally came to this position of you could say on top of the creation worlds. I mean, he's not the very top, but he's for many, many people, the majority of people, he is the ruler, the god that people worship. And he has at least three attributes that we know of, and those are the good, the beneficial, the benevolent god who grants prayers and the wishes of people who bow down to him. He can do that too. He has the power to grant wishes and desires, and he'll do that once in a while just to you know, give the people hope. And then there's the devil part of him, the evil part of him. That's basically he plays both sides. So that's interesting about this fellow. He has both the devil and the good guy. You've watched Devil's Advocate, that movie with Al Pacino. That's kind of a good example of how, you know, he's actually both good and bad. And then on the side there, there's the influence, and that's the sum total, basically, of all people's desires, unconscious and conscious. And it's kind of a form from people in the creation world, because this is creation. So people create, and then from that creation, this entity, you could say, is formed, and it travels around, you could say, and just does havoc and, you know, does tap lining, you could say, or controlling people through their own desires that they've created. But it forms into like this one huge entity, and he uses that, the Cal or the Grog uses that, and they have a relationship. And so it's interesting how it all works together. There's you could say one, but then it splits, and it's the good, the bad, and the you know, the desire part. of life and creation. And these are all influences that we have to work with. I mean, these are all effects. And that, like, I know what you're doing with this show is, like, you know, we can be caused and be conscious of what's going on and actually get beyond all this nonsense. So I hope that helps.
Okay, well, thank you, Val. And so the other part of the show, I wanted to show how most of the religions on this planet are the same. And so you have what we're familiar with is the main religion, and you on the third plane, the third heaven, and he has what we call three heads. You have what you call the good guy, the bad guy, and then the influence, the one that influences people. Well, here's an interesting thing. So here's Hinduism. Hinduism is a major religion. So I looked that up, and I found that Hinduism is the third largest religion in the world, with nearly a billion adherents worldwide. Hinduism is the world's third largest religion after Christianity and Islam. And Hindu often focuses on individual disciplines such as meditation, yoga, chants, burning incense and all that. And then in recent years, Hare Krishna, New Age groups and all that kind of stuff. And what's interesting about Hinduism, they believe that you have to do good works and have good karma in order to go to heaven and move on. And they believe in reincarnation and all that stuff. But once again, Hindu believes in the three heads. They have their God has three heads. And you have Brahma, which is the creator God. You have Vishnu, the preserver God, and Shiva, the destroyer God. So you have the good, the bad, and the preserver is probably the one who it would be the same as the influence, I would guess. So the good guy creates everything, Shiva destroys everything, and Vishnu is a preserver. In Christianity, I finally figured out why in Christianity they have the Old Testament and the New Testament combined, is because the Old Testament represents the bad God, the God that goes around destroying whole nations of people to the man, every man, woman, child, and even all the animals. And then you have Jesus, the good guy, who is the good head of the Trinity. And then you have the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit, which the influence. And in Christianity, you're not going very far in Christianity unless you receive the Holy Spirit, which is the influence. So once you receive the influence of the Holy Spirit, then you're totally tap-lined. You know, you're taking hook, line, and sinker, and it's pretty hard to give up that belief after you've done that. And, I'm kind of running out of time now, but it's kind of interesting how these religions work with the different governments. You know, like you have the Vatican and all these organizations, they work hand in hand. I don't know if you're familiar with the Society of Jesus, which is a big part of the Catholic Church and the Black Pope. I have an article here that goes into detail and explains how the Society of Jesus employs the services of the NSA, DHS, FEMA, OSS, ONI, FBI, CIA, DIA, DEA, the Pentagon, Department of Defense, NASA, the Federal Reserve, the Internal Revenue Service, Congress, and other federal agencies as necessary, and that's in the United States. And overseas, they use the German SS, Deutsch, the underground Abwehr, DVD, the British MI6 and MI5. They use the Israeli Mossad. They use NATO, Interpol, the KGB, the Chilean DINA, and even the United Nations. These religious organizations work directly with the governments to accomplish their missions using the highest levels of intelligence and government agencies. Well, I think I'm running out of time. There's one thing I want to say. We know that the reptilians are on a real mission to destroy this planet. And I don't know if any of you heard it yesterday. The United Nations had just completed a study, and they made an announcement yesterday that there are over 1 million species of plants and animals that are on the verge of extinction. They just made a public statement yesterday in the news. So since we're running out of time here, anybody like to add any last-minute comment or anything?
Just that you gave us so much information that there is no way you can deny what's being presented. But I think a lot of people listen to everything that's being said, but they don't speak about it because it's dangerous to their family, their jobs, even their lives. So they may be there in the background and you not know it, that they're there trying to do what we are trying to do, which is save the planet, the people on it, and to get rid of the bad reptilians. There may be more out there than we even suspect out of the 8 billion people on this planet. A lot of them know it. This broadcast goes around the world. And people tell their friends or their families about it. So, yes, this is wonderful. Thank you for being brave and stepping up and saying something. There's nobody very much out there doing that. But soon there will be, because their people are catching on that they have been deceived. And because they've been deceived, they start thinking about things. And when you start thinking about things, you have a different idea come across. And there are many, many, many good reptilians helping us as we speak, trying to save our little planet. Because saving Earth is a very, very crucial and important job. And it's quite an adventure. Thank you, Bob.
Well, thank you, Claudia. And as I say to people now, welcome to Jurassic Park. We're Jurassic Park in reverse. It's the reptilians that are designer engineering the humans instead of us designer engineering the reptilians in Jurassic Park. So, for anybody out there that's a UFO guy and can't figure out why the government will not reveal the truth about UFOs, about the aliens, because our government is the aliens. So that'll finish the show. And since we're running out of time, I want to finish with everybody singing New You, and we can do it all at once. There's probably countless number of people on here, and I don't know everybody's names on here. So, well, everybody on the count of three, just sing New You, and then that'll be it for our show today. So one, two. Call, you have one last thing?
No, just thank you.
Okay.
Thank
okay.
You, Bob.
On the count of three, everybody. One, two, three. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for participating. All right. Bye now.
Bye.